My first really serious relationship, I was in my 20s, and I thought, man, it'd be really useful if there was some like green light in the corner that would go off and say, this is as good as it's going to get. That person doesn't need to be your everything, but they need to be many things. It's the most complex, multifaceted relationship you'll ever get into. There's these tools you can use to basically have the conversation earlier, and lots of things come out of that. Lots of disagreements, lots of agreements and alignment. And you kind of surface where the friction points are, and then you can dig into the beliefs. This sounds kind of edgy, right? This is more than what I had bargained for. My sort of contrarian viewpoint is that most people compromise too much in relationships. And what I mean by that is they make bad compromises.
In this episode of Modern Relationships, I'm joined by Jared Fleisler, a seasoned Silicon Valley operator who's worked at Google, Square, and Scribd, and now works as a coach for founders. Jared shares his perspective on identifying core values and potential partners, the art of compromise versus horse trading, and how to navigate the question of whether someone is good enough. He also offers lots of practical wisdom around building connection, co-living experiments, and engaging in long-distance relationships. Jared, welcome to Modern Relationships. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
One thing we were talking offline is this idea about how no person is going to be absolutely perfect. And so how do you know when someone is good enough? And how do you get excited about good enough without feeling like you're settling? Or even just how should we think about that concept?
Yeah. I wish I had the perfect answer for this. I mean, I know this is something we talked about as something that comes up. You know, for me, I've been in a bunch of different relationships for different periods of time. I think I've lived with four partners, and I've been engaged once, and I've been in non-traditional relationships. And it's always this tough thing. I remember my first really serious relationship. I was in my 20s, and I thought, man, it'd be really useful if there was some like green light in the corner that would go off and say, this is as good as it's going to get. Like, this is the best fit you're going to find. Yeah, sure, there's some disagreements, there's this, there's that. But, you know, there isn't really that indicator. Because I think the hard part is we tell ourselves this fairy tale. You know, for a long time, we dream about Mr. and Mrs. Right, and we kind of make them out of clay in our mind. And then you start dating somebody, and they're not quite what you were expecting. And in some ways, it surprised you on the positive side. And you learn that there are things that you really want a partner that you had never thought about. And then in other ways, you learn that there's things that you really want in a partner that you didn't know, you know, or like there's some that you knew that you wanted, and some things that you didn't know that now you think, man, I really need that in a partner. And I think the challenge with this is that you don't really know what the comparison is. You know, there's kind of this wish that you knew, well, if I ended this relationship, what is that alternative relationship that I would enter? And you never really know that. And so I think there's work to do with yourself that happens. I haven't found a better way other than dating, you know, kissing a lot of frogs or dating the wrong people, but finding out, like, what is the thing that you keep coming back to that matters most? And I love that Dan Savage talks about this as like, make your list of must-haves. And if that list is over five, you're the problem. You know, you gotta read a set list. And so I think the same thing is true for your partner. Like, you know, as you and your partner are talking about what's most important to them, you have to get down to a really small list of must-haves, and everything else is negotiable.
And what are yours, or what are example ones to, you know, like, and of course, like, what's not on there? You know, what's on there, what's not on there?
Sure. So I think that when you think about a partner, what you really want is values alignment. So if you go underneath all of the, you know, random thoughts or beliefs or actions or tactics, you really want somebody who's aligned with you in their thinking, so that hopefully they approach the world and all of the situations you haven't even encountered yet in a way that roughly makes sense to you. And this is the same thing we do in companies, right? When you hire people, you try to talk to them about why you're making the decisions you're making and how they think about it, how you think about that. And it's less about like showing them, where you come to me and you go, hey, Jared, what should I do in this situation? it's not about going like, oh, well, Eric, like, choose the blue one. If I did that, then you wouldn't really learn anything about, well, what do I do next time? You would just come back to me and say, Jared, what should I do? And so I think with a partner, it's the same way. Like, how do you get into the underlying beliefs and core principles and values? Because those are the things that are going to shape how you build a life together, how you choose your priority in work or in the rest of your life, how you think about building a family, your thoughts on right and wrong. And I think that that gets magnified if you decide to have a kid. Because now you have this person that you're trying to teach this subjective concept of right and wrong to. And if your values misalign with your partner, it doesn't matter if you guys both decided to be super ambitious and make lots of money and both want to live in San Francisco and, you know, like love dogs. That doesn't really help you with teaching right and wrong to your offspring. And so I think you want to think about, like, what are those core beliefs? And so one for me, for example, is around kindness. I realized I dated some people that were kind and I just took that for granted. You know, then I dated somebody who wasn't very kind. And I watched how they treated people in the world around us. And I realized that just every time I heard them talk to a waiter or waitress at a restaurant or to the cashier at the grocery store and ignore that person or treat that person like they weren't an equal, that it just kind of grated on me at this really foundational level that made me frustrated and angry. And I realized that that was going to ripple out. And if this person just treated the world in that way, like there was this class system and they were better than other people and they didn't lead with kindness, that was like foundationally a part of my belief system, a way that I thought one should be. And so I think figuring out, like, what are the things that you think are the right way to live your life, the right way to be in the world, and making sure that you align on those things with your partner.
What's not on the list, or maybe put differently, how did that list evolve over time?
Yeah. Well, I'm curious also, as you think about this, you know, what those things are that come to mind for you. But like, I'll give my first answer. That is, I think if I look at myself, right, like before I dealt with the relationships, I just dealt with myself and my own life, my own choices, deciding if my path was the right one for me. And when I was younger, I simplified how to make those choices. And I just thought about it was sort of Maslow's hierarchy. It's easy when you can't, you know, you got to pay rent and you need shelter and food and this, like, it's actually easier to make decisions because you have a base set of needs and you're acting out of this place of need. When you get to this luxurious place of where you have your core needs met, well, then you're just making choices and every choice has a trade-off, but there's no need. You don't go hungry if you choose X career versus Y career, or if you choose to live in this neighborhood versus that neighborhood, or this partner versus that partner. And so I actually think it becomes more complex. And I think this has a big impact on our overall happiness in our lives and with our partners. Because if you go way back in time, where foundationally people thought about happiness and success as this kind of like simplified list of 5 to 10 things that were very much around like survival and procreation and security, it's a little bit easier. You know, the litmus test, or maybe a lot bit easier, the litmus test of am I succeeding on those things for my grandparents was a bit more simple and straightforward and objective than the am I succeeding in my relationship, you know, 50 years later for me and for my partner. And so I think that the younger version of Jared had a list of things like, is this person ambitious and career oriented? You know, is this person going to prioritize X over Y? Like, it was very focused around, like, does their lifestyle match with my lifestyle? Like, do we have a lot in common around that lifestyle? And now, you know, my partner is actually quite a few years younger than me. And I see a lot of the behaviors and priorities that I used to have in him. And what I see in that is less about the tactics or the outcomes and more about, right, there's an underlying core value system and drive that I feel really connected to and that I actually think is on my short list. Like, hey, I want to have somebody who's driven and somebody who's excited. And I say someone who has like a brightness of future, like an excitement about what the future holds. Like that mentality, that way of being in that core belief and value system, those are the things that the later, you know, more mature version of me starts to value more. And it's less about the tactics of where this person is exactly in their life at this moment.
Yeah.
I can resonate with a lot of that. For me, I always, you know, I'm always sort of, you know, as we all are, very sensitive to the people around me and become, you know, more like them, to the, you know, the quote people say about you're the average of the five people you spent the most time with. And so I've always thought about partnership in terms of that, in terms of, you know, making me more of who I want to be. And in my 20s and even early 30s, I was, you know, career ambition was the thing I was thinking, you know, the most about, perhaps, or certainly really highly. And some of it was Maslow hierarchy, as you said, of like, you know, just got to make it. But also part of it was, you know, wanting to, you know, prove myself and achieve something and contribute something. So, you know, a mix of clean and dirty fuel, perhaps. And I used to, you know, pick partners who really inspired me in that way. And then I think, you know, more recently, I think, you know, I've started to think more about, you know, things like family and things like who I want to be in a more, as you said, kind of values, you know, basis. I still really respect and appreciate, you know, people who are ambitious and have life force and stuff like that and want peer, you know, a peer, et cetera. But it's just a different prioritization of those values.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think if you add, I don't know how you think about kids, but when you add that lens in, that really starts to shift things, because there's things I just didn't think about as a kid or as a younger version of myself that I think about a lot now. And so just like to give a specific example of this, my partner lives in a pretty small town in the hometown that he grew up in. And he lives a 7-minute drive from his parents. And he sees his parents multiple times a week. And they are very involved in our lives. And I run into his mom at the store and his dad picks me up and gives me rides places. And we have dinner with them and lunch with them. Like, I see them a lot more than my own parents. And for me, my family's close, but we've always lived at a distance in my adult life. And so I don't know, I just never really fully thought about like, how important is it to have my family really nearby? That wasn't some core value system that I grew up with. It's not something that I was like familiar with. And so I hadn't really thought about it. And then I started dating him, and, you know, one thing led to another. And at some point when we're in a serious relationship and we're really near his family, I'm like, wow, this feels great. And I get to see his brother who has one, soon to be two young kids, and I get to see their interactions. And all of a sudden, this idea of like, what's it like for grandparents to be close to your kids is something that starts to bubble up as something that's pretty important. But ask 25-year-old Jared, and he wasn't thinking about that at all. Right? So I think also like the stage that you're in life and the things, as soon as things stop being a risk to you, you're like, okay, I can have the shelter and I can have the food and I can take care of my needs. Then you start to think about like, what kind of life do I want to live? And what do I think is important for my kids? And what do I think is healthy for me? And what puts me and my partner in a state where we have enough space and, you know, can disagree and are managing our stress so that it doesn't come into the relationship, it doesn't impact our kids. So like, I just think our lives change. And as they change, we look at kind of the new standards, the new things that are important to us, those new priorities. And then we have to adapt, like, who do we want to be in partnership with? And what are the things we value around that?
Yeah. Double clicking on sort of the evolution, you know, one response could be, hey, no regrets. You needed everything, you know, you go to everything to get to where you are now. But I am curious if the, you know, 40-year-old Jared could give advice to the, you know, 20-year-old or 25-year-old or 30-year-old based on what you know now and thinking about what kind of life you might want. What might you tell the younger versions of Jared, either as it relates to relationships or perhaps more broadly as it relates to, you know, what makes you happy?
I think there's a tendency to kind of like wish away the pain, like wish away the hard parts of whatever the younger version of you went through. And the hard part with that is like, who knows who you would have become. I'm reading a book and they're talking about dyslexia and about how some of the greatest minds in the world had dyslexia and how it's so tough for people that are dyslexic to read. And reading is so foundational to society and to learning. And so like these people really had to struggle to get through, but some part of that struggle then made them incredibly successful. And some of them, their kids are dyslexic and they watch how they struggle. They wouldn't wish that dyslexia on someone, but it's unclear who they would have become had they not been dyslexic, right? And so I think that this is really tough for us to go back in time and go, man, what would I have changed? Even telling yourself like, it's all going to be okay, or you're going to find your partner at 40, or you're going to do this, or you're going to do that. Like, don't worry, don't have so many sleepless nights about, you know, that breakup that you spent 2 years, 3 years thinking about and then finally pulling the trigger on. Like, just do it. And the challenge of that is like, I don't know, that pain and suffering did something to shape who you are today. And so without knowing what that alternative is, I think it's a dangerous thing to go and, you know, play with the past. There's a reason why in every sci-fi movie, when they go back in time, they're not allowed to touch anything or make any changes. And so I don't know. I mean, I guess if I was talking to a younger person today who was really caught up in figuring it out or having all of the answers in their 20s or even in their 30s, I might tell them just that my own perspective on it shifted dramatically and invite them to the possibility that that could happen for them. Just for them to not feel like they have the pressure or the burden that they need to figure it all out early on, or that just because they're nose to the grindstone and prioritizing work above all else doesn't mean that they're not going to prioritize love at some point. And so lots of people ask me this, like my first relationship when I was with my, or not my first relationship, but my first serious relationship, when I met my partner at the time, I told him, hey, you know, I have a really important relationship in my life and it takes priority over everything else. And that's with my job. And I just want to make sure, like, I kind of reserve the right to not be able to go on vacations and to have to cancel dinners and to have to, you know, basically go on my phone and to do this and to have it encroach on our quality time. And I just need to make sure that we're on the same page about that. And when I tell that to people, they're like, are you crazy? You know, you basically told your partner that your job was a bigger priority than they were. And I was like, well, that's where I was in my life at the time. And I wanted to like have that discussion up front versus have that discussion in the disagreement every time I reached and pulled out my phone. Now, in my life today, 15 years later, there's a different set of priorities. And if I took out my phone during the middle of dinner one-on-one with my partner, that would not be okay because that's not part of our shared agreement, you know? But when I did that when I was 25 or 26, that was expected, right? I might get my laptop out and put it on the dinner table because I was in a different environment that was so critical. My partner knew that. He knew what he signed up for, right? So I don't regret that. I don't want to go back in time and say like, man, you had the wrong priorities. Like, look where your life is now. It's like, no, me having those priorities allowed for me to have a whole bunch of things that in part allowed for me to get to where I am today and to have this life that I have. And so I think you got to be careful about changing the past.
Yeah, it's interesting.
We'll get right back to the conversation after a word from our sponsors. Modern Relationships is sponsored by Relationship Hero, your personal relationship coach. It's an open secret in Silicon Valley that people are using these relationship coaches. Over 100,000 users are happy they tried Relationship Hero. You might be wondering, what is it like to talk to a relationship coach? Well, here's Jackie Pugh, a senior coach at Relationship Hero.
That's a really good question. Okay, I actually just got off a call with a client who was getting mixed signals from his ex. So she's the one that broke up with him, but then she kept sending him these really heartfelt, long, emotional messages at midnight, and then in the morning would act like nothing ever happened.
We've all been there. How do you recommend handling something like that?
So what we would do is we would want to hear exactly what's going on so we can help discern, is my client's ex, is she just trying to process her emotions and she's doing it via text message? Is she potentially trying to keep my client on the back burner? Or is she actually trying to reconnect? And if she is, then I help my client decide, you know, is this something that he actually wants to do, reconnect? And if so, why?
Thanks, Jackie. If you want to try your first one-on-one or couples coaching session, go to relationshiphero.com/modern. You'll get $50 off your first session if you use our link. Again, that's relationshiphero.com/modern.
I want to double click more on the shared agreements that you mentioned, because you're someone I've, you know, been lucky to work with you, and you're very thoughtful as it relates to communication and expectation setting and sort of checking in and just sort of the quality of the relationship. in a business context where people are usually, you know, more deliberate about that. And there's all these sorts of frameworks, but you're also interested in it in a personal context as well, or thoughtful about it. So I'm curious if you could share more about maybe some tools to align on what really matters early on, or maybe just more broadly.
Yeah. I don't know for the folks that end up listening to this, kind of where their mindset is at, but I'll share my mindset, and knowing you quite a bit, I suspect it's similar. As I've gotten older, I feel like my time is more finite. And I've realized this through a variety of things. One is, you know, your body starts changing, your energy levels start changing, and you just realize you're not, you know, the 21-year-old version of yourself anymore. But you also start to see things around you shift. So now it feels like every person in my world who's going to have kids is having kids, and they're doing it all right now, or they already did, you know? And so now I'm constantly surrounded by kids and families, and that starts to bubble up, you know, in the straight community that happens earlier. And I thought for a while, like, okay, this just isn't as common in the gay world. And now most of my gay friends that are in longstanding relationships are now starting to have kids. And so suddenly that pressure starts to build, and what is normal around you starts to change. And so for me, I realized, man, you know, this idea that someday maybe I'll have kids, that when I was 25, I thought maybe I will, maybe I won't. At some point it starts to shift into like, if I am going to have kids, I probably want to start doing it pretty soon, right? Like, I don't plan to have kids when I'm 60. So you start to realize that, you know, time does matter and it's having an impact on you. And so when I got into a relationship, you know, as I got into like my mid-30s, when I got into relationships, I was really looking for a husband, right? Like a life partner. And so my desire was, how can I figure out if this person is my life partner as soon as possible? And I imagine some people feel that way, like, okay, great. What are the 5 questions I should ask? Can I send them a quiz? You know, is there an interview process? Is there like a set of tools I can do? Unfortunately, I do not have the perfect answer, a set of 10 questions that you should ask to figure out if somebody is your life partner. But I do think that you can date in a much more intentional and thoughtful way. There's this balance, right? Because you're building this connection with this person. And if on your second date, you run them through a series of 40 questions, especially with lots of controversial answers, you may not have the foundation where they feel and you feel like it's worth going through the trenches together and getting to the other side. I do think that you can figure out what are your core beliefs, what are the things that are important to you, and you can have questions about those early on. And I've heard about the people that go on their first date and they talk about whether or not they want kids and, you know, what's important to them and go through their punch list. I think there are variants of that. And so there are lists of intentional relating questions or conscious relationship questions that you can ask, which basically give you scenarios. And then you can talk about those scenarios, and there's no right or wrong. It's just saying, okay, here are these questions in this situation. What would you do? What do you, and then there is a book called The Hard Questions, which a number of friends have used and I've used, which asks you questions in a number of different verticals in your life, you know, finances, work, sex, kids, all sorts of different areas that ask you about questions for you to contemplate. And it's a little bit less about the specific question. It's more about how you answer it and the things that drive you to it. So many people I've heard go through these questions, say, well, it wasn't the right question. You know, well, we created our own questions. Great. Fantastic. Whatever works for you. But I think it causes you to bring forward a set of conversations that you will someday have. And if you have those conversations 4 years in and you find out that you're really misaligned, and that is absolutely critical and important for you, it would have been really helpful to find that out maybe 3 months into your relationship. And so I would say for most people, if you do, you know, 3 to 6 months into the relationship, you're kind of building foundation, you're figuring out if this person is a good vibe and fit with you, and you surface this idea, I think you'll have a pretty good sense at that point. Like, is this person interested in conscious relating and in perhaps going to the next level of exploring where you all have alignment? Then there's these tools you can use to basically have the conversation earlier, and lots of things come out of that. Lots of disagreements, lots of agreements and alignment. And you kind of surface where the friction points are, And then you can dig into the beliefs. So all of this is really just getting at the same thing we talked about at the beginning, which is the most important thing to align on is your core belief system and your values. And so when you answer these questions, I'll give you an example. One of the conscious relating questions was, how would you feel about having help or assistance in the house? And when people talk about this, it surfaces some underlying core values and beliefs. You may hear everything from like, that's absurd. You mean have other people take care of my kids? Like, I don't want to be an absentee parent. I'm not going to do this. And you may hear the total other extreme, which is absolutely, we're working and we should hire as many people as possible to help in the house because that's not something that I want to do. And I think that's really fine. And the minute we get the chance, we're sending our kids to boarding school. And you're like, wow, these are very different viewpoints. And as you dig back into like, well, what led you to believe this? And what was your childhood like? And is that an experience you went through? You can start to build empathy and figure out like, can you get to a place of alignment? And if you can't, like, that's a good thing to know, right? That you, then you're really tapping into the underlying beliefs that are going to shape a bunch of things in your shared life.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And one thing I want to point out is that, you know, you're interesting because you spent, you know, a decade plus, it seems, in San Francisco at, you know, very competitive, ambitious places with some of the most, you know, competitive and ambitious people in the world. And you decided to, both on the operating path and on the venture path, and you decided to leave San Francisco and go to Austin and sort of embrace this more community-driven life and at a bit calmer pace. Feel free to edit my characterization. But I'm curious how you think about that values evolution and if you could share more about that, because that's, you know, a lot of people also spend a decade in Silicon Valley, you know, do a little bit well for themselves and then, you know, pick their head up and say, hey, do I just want to keep running this back or, you know, do I want to do something different? And my guess is that most people end up staying because, you know, people, it's what they know, but you made a sort of what seems like a deliberate choice. So I'm curious if you talk more about it.
Yeah. So some of this I can say was intentional and some of it was not really part of the decision. It just sort of where the cards fell. When I left San Francisco, my thought was not, oh, I'm going to like switch into neutral or, you know, take a big step back and calm down and be less competitive or any of that. It was, well, we've managed through COVID. Something like 50% of those same most ambitious people I worked with and knew and had built careers and companies left San Francisco. And that meant that you could be ambitious and successful and do big things and work in big jobs and not have to be in San Francisco. And so the way that I described other people is like, it was career suicide for most of my life to leave San Francisco until COVID. And then when COVID came, it stopped being career suicide and lots of people left and lots of people continued in their careers and on their path and continued to be very ambitious. And the other thing is like, it's not a one-way door, you know, flights go in both directions. And so if there was that trade-off that came with it, I knew that I could always get back on a plane and move back to San Francisco and go back into it. It just wasn't what I believed that trade-off would be. Now, that said, I did make some very conscious choices. The primary thing that drove for me was realizing I had a picture in my head, like I think many people do, of what their life looked like, you know, 10, 20, 30 years from now. And I imagined being married and having kids and having a big yard and having a pool in the back and having a summer. And, you know, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. And so like we had four seasons and we had a life that kind of looked like this. I think for a lot of people, they think back on their childhood and they go, okay, I want a childhood just like that. Or I want a childhood totally different for my kids. And for me, it's like, I want a childhood kind of similar to what I had. I thought it was great. You know, I really enjoy the kind of environment that I live in. And it's hard for me to think about raising small kids in San Francisco. It just didn't feel like the place that I saw a lot of successful families, that I saw a lot of people finding that prioritization for their kids in the way that I wanted and the right sort of balance around that. And when I went to visit other places, I actually moved to Denver first for 6 months and then to Austin. In Austin, what I saw was there was a lot of people in my same headspace, people that were in their 30s who had had some success, who wanted to go to the next chapter of life, of starting a family and building, but were still ambitious and still wanted to do something big with their careers. They weren't like giving up on the rest of their life and just going into neutral and saying, great, now I'm going to be a family man and I'm not going to do anything else in my life. And in Denver, I felt more of that. I felt a lot more of the, hey, I'm switching away from work and into other priorities. Whereas in Austin, I feel that it's more of a, hey, I want my family life to feel like this, and work continues to be really important. There continue to be really ambitious people and projects and creativity and things that I was looking for. And frankly, just with like a bit more space and the ability for the average person in the city to make it. You know, I used to think like in San Francisco, I was very lucky. I had a nice apartment and I would host people for dinner. And if I think about the number of times that I hosted people for dinner versus the number of times that other people hosted dinners, it is pretty crazy, right? Like there were very few people that I knew that would host dinners at their homes. Part of that is like a city culture thing. That's just not what people do in cities as often. Part of that is people didn't have nice enough places where they felt comfortable doing that. And when I went to Austin, you know, I've been in Austin for 3 years. I was in San Francisco for almost 20. I've been to probably 10 times the number of gatherings and dinners at people's homes that I went to in San Francisco. And I just, that to me, again, is like reminiscent of my childhood. It's what I want for a community. It's what I want my kids to grow up in. And so for me, that was a big push to say, hey, I've got to find the environment that supports both myself and my career and where I am, what I want to do and my ambitions, but also supports that picture of what I want to have in the future. And when I was in San Francisco, I just didn't feel like that. I felt like it was very supportive of Jared in his 20s and 30s and career being almost, you know, the single-minded mission. But it wasn't very supportive of Jared, you know, as a husband, a partner, a father. It was just hard for me to wrap my head around.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, to that point, say more about living in community, what that means to you. How is this something that you think you will do even when you have children and family? And do you think it's something that more people should be thinking about, this sort of co-living like arrangement? What are sort of the sort of pros and cons, or how should one think about it?
Yeah. So just to give some background, I live in community, and oftentimes when I describe it, people's first reaction is, oh, so you have roommates. And so, well, no, it's not exactly that. So I'll explain what I mean by that. And I'll give some background so I'm not the crazy person on the podcast talking about living in some weird cycle.
Polyamory orgies, that's what.
Yeah, you know, share this and that. So, you know, when I've talked to people about this, the most common reaction is, wow, that's such like a novel, crazy new idea. And the reality is it's actually a really old idea. And it's actually what we did as society in most places around the world, and what people continue to do in many, many countries around the world, including, you know, in a way you could think about it as my partner who lives in a small town with his family living 5 to 7 minutes away and his brother living in the next town over, in a way lives in much more community than most of the people that I know in America who live at a distance from their families and don't have close ties right around them. So for me, I, during COVID, didn't want to be in my apartment by myself in my little isolation chamber in San Francisco. And I talked to my boyfriend at the time and this couple that we were friends with. And we said, hey, what if we rented a house out in nature? You know, we want to be able to get outside, get exercise, and we just want to have more space. Like, we never really thought we would be holed up in our apartments. My boyfriend had a 2-year-old husky and lived in a studio apartment in Oakland. You know, we just wanted to have space, wanted the dog to be able to run around. It was very difficult to feel like you could be safe and you could see people and you could be out in space. And we also thought it was going to be better, more interesting and healthier for us to live in community with some other people and in a bubble versus just living by ourselves. And so we moved out to the middle of nowhere to a place called Ukiah. It's about 3 hours north of San Francisco. You go until you're certain that you missed it and you drive about an hour further. And that's right when you hit it, right as cell phone service cuts out. And so we drove up a dirt road and we lived on this little hill on 15 acres overlooking these vineyards. It was beautiful. We were just in the middle of nowhere. And it was so relaxing at a time that was so stressful and so crazy in so many other ways. And work was just all on for all four of us. it was so relaxing to walk outside and take a breath of fresh air, to see deer come up to the fence, to see eagles in the sky. And I just realized that this kind of nourishment from nature was so important for me, and that I had been in this kind of treadmill of being in a city and then visiting nature to like recharge, that instead, as like at this moment in my life, like I really want that battery that recharges me to be all around me instead of being in the city. And so I started, that was my first experiment with living in community. And for the next year or so, I explored different ways of living in community. We lived with this other couple for a number of months. And then we got a group of 10 people together and we all lived together for a month, and another group of about 8 people and lived together for a month. And I had a number of friends that tried this and generally had similar results where they really enjoyed pieces of it. Not all of it, but pieces of it. And so when it came time for me to leave San Francisco, I randomly got introduced to a guy in Austin who had lived in a co-living like warehouse of about 20 residents in Brooklyn. And we got introduced and we talked about how we wanted to live. And I shared with him the stories of what I had done during COVID. And he shared with me some of his stories of living in Brooklyn. And there was an intentionality, similar to the intentionality that I think is really helpful when you're trying to find a sexual partner or a romantic partner. There's this intentionality about, hey, this is what I want to create. I had this thought, oh, I'm going to move to Texas. There's all this land. I had never been to Austin. I'm going to buy a bunch of land and I'm going to subdivide it. My favorite people in the world over time, like if Austin's the panacea, the place where we should all do the next chapter of our lives, then great. I'll build a house there and a life. People will come visit. And over time, they'll just take plots of this land around where I build the house, and we'll create this community of all these friends living next door to each other. I mean, you have to have neighbors. They might as well be people that you actually like. And so this wasn't a very controversial concept. I get to Austin and I find out actually there's a lot of people that had moved there before me. The land was not quite as plentiful as I thought in my imagination. You know, the city was quite built out. And I met this guy, Kayvon, who was very interested in living in community. And he had bought a house and moved there from New York and said, hey, I want to build a co-living home. It feels really similar to what you're wanting. Do you want to do that with me? And I thought, well, I need to move somewhere. And I hadn't signed a lease yet. And it was a 6-month lease. And I thought, this sounds kind of edgy, right? This is more than what I had bargained for. I just thought I'd be neighbors, you know, with my friends or with people I liked. But this is actually like in the same home. And so we agreed that we would try living together for 6 months. And the reason why it's not just roommates is we spent a decent amount of time talking about what our belief systems were, talking about what our paths were in life, talking about what we were excited about, talking about what energized us, and finding this fit with each other where we're like, hey, we're actually really excited to like live life together, to build something together. Same way that you would if you started dating somebody. And so we created a 14-page house manual. We created norms and communication, rules around the space. We have retros every 2 weeks where we talk about what's causing friction and what's working and what's missing. You know, we iterate, we do co-creation projects that are art projects or parties or other types of events. Like, it's far more communal in nature in terms of what we're creating and kind of the brand and essence around the house. And we hope that the house will like continue to live on even if we don't live there. And so there's this open question of like, well, what happens once you have kids? And now Kayvon actually just got engaged. And so this question is coming up as we talk about it. Like, am I signed up to live with some little kids that are going to come into our lives? And first his partner moved in with us and that was a discussion. So I had to meet with her and we went through conversations around our value systems and things that we hold near and dear. But this isn't a free for all. It's not like a roommate moves in and we renegotiate the norms around our living. We have norms around how we live that we've tested. We're open to changing those if there's a good discussion and a good reason around it. But it's far more intentional and thought out than just, hey, we'll figure out whether or not you think you should put dishes in the dishwasher. It's like, no, we have a thought around why that is. And the thing that guides that behavior is a belief system and a value system around conscientiousness and consideration and doing more for the next person than has been done for you, to leave it as an N+1 experience. And so those core aligned beliefs then bleed into the decisions that we make as a house. So I don't know exactly what form or structure my life will take, you know, once I have kids. But yeah, I'd like to live in community of one form or another. I think it's kind of crazy that we go and we try to do this all on our own, from childcare to, you know, having these events to taking in the packages, like, and it's just based on any one person being in a house. And that when we live in communities, whether those are communities of larger buildings where you hire a doorman or, you know, you have something like this, you suddenly have this support team around you that's helping out. And that used to be your family, and now it might be your friends. But I think there's like a modern way to approach these communities or these villages that's very similar to what we used to do.
Fascinating. And so what's like a rule or a value or norm that you guys might have that might be different than, you know, standard sort of similar arrangements?
I'll give you my a funny little one. So we clean the lint out of the dryer trap after we do our laundry. And if you think about it, if you don't have that rule, you do your laundry, the dryer trap has lint in it, and that's fine because it's 100% fair. Every person who goes to do their laundry, they have to clean the lint out before they start their load of laundry. But that's a missed opportunity to pass the buck, to do something for the next person. And so we have this value around, like, what are the opportunities we have in the house to do something nice for the next person? And so we say, hey, you should clean the dryer lint after you're done using laundry. It has no benefit to you. It's just doing something for the next person. And so if we can constantly do that, we have values around gratitude and recognition. We have a WhatsApp chat where we call things out, both things that we're grateful for, but we also call things out when they're out of place or they're inconsistent with the guidelines or the rules of the house. And so we have a lot of transparency, and the feedback that we've gotten from people is that it feels really safe to call out things that aren't as they should be according to the agreements that we have in the house. And so it's very similar to other relationships. We have shared agreements. When those agreements aren't met, it's very normal to call out that those agreements aren't being adhered to and to have a discussion around it versus avoiding that or building resentment or not knowing how to address it. And so we are in a constant state of feedback and discussion that I think is takes a minute to get used to, but also results in, I've lived there for almost 3 years, and we have these incredibly long-standing relationships with people who really feel like what we've built is a family versus just roommates.
That's a great overview. Shifting back to romantic relationships, you mentioned that you've been in a few over the years. You were engaged once. How do you think about, or how would you recommend other people also think about when to call it quits in a relationship?
So I think there's two things that you have to figure out in every relationship. One is if you like the other person and you want to be in partnership with them, and the second is what your life path looks like and how aligned that is with theirs. You may find somebody that you absolutely love and you guys are amazing roommates and you get along and you have a shared sense of excitement, and their life path that they are committed to is moving to another country and living out their days there and being far away from family, and like, they're excited to explore the world and they want to be a nomad and, you know, they want to do all these things. And your life path is like, you want to move back to your hometown and you want to be close to your family and you want to anchor into community and you want to put down deep roots. And actually, like, the life that they are describing sounds chaotic and stressful and really different than what you want. And the life that you want to them sounds sedentary and boring and stationary. No matter how much you love that person, no matter how excited you are about the time that you spend with them right now, where your paths are aligned because they're in San Francisco and they've only been there for 6 months and it's still new and exciting and fun, but in a year they plan to leave. You just happen to be in the same place at the same time, enjoying each other's company, but they're going over here and you're going over here. And those things don't really work out together. And I've experienced this. I met someone amazing at the very, very beginning of COVID, and we had this great relationship, and I still deeply love them. And when we talked about the life that we each want, we have very, very different pictures of what makes us happy. And as soon as we came out of COVID, turned out that COVID he's a bit more of an introvert and quieter and kind of wants less socialization and to be in a little bit more of a rural setting. Well, during COVID, we like lived almost off the grid and it was a very quiet life. And as soon as we got out of COVID, life went back to what was normal for me of socializing and seeing lots of friends and doing lots of things, which to him was exhausting. It was really tough. It wasn't how he wanted to live his life. And it was this strange feeling of, I love this person. I spent the last 2 years with them. You know, we really enjoy each other's company. All of these things make sense, but where we're going in our lives, what we want is really misaligned. And if we're not honest with ourselves about that, it's just going to cause us friction. Every time we do something I want to do, he's going to feel pulled out of his comfort zone. Every time we do something he wants, I'm going to feel like it's not quite where I want to be. And so I think you have to be really clear and honest about that with your romantic partner, because you're basically choosing a roommate. You're choosing a co-parent. If you're going to have kids, you know, you're choosing a travel buddy. You're choosing an adventure partner. You're choosing a career partner. You're choosing all of these things. And that's why romantic partnerships are so difficult. Like, our friends don't have to go through that. You don't meet somebody and go, do you satisfy all these boxes? No, you meet somebody at the gym and they like working out. And you like working out. You guys decide to do some workouts together. And then at some point you decide, hey, we're going to go get lunch. Oh man, like I really enjoy it. They like good food. Okay, maybe we'll start being dinner buddies. Oh man, they like traveling. Maybe we'll start traveling together, right? It organically builds. But in a partnership, there's this assumption, and I think a lot of it is right, that that person doesn't need to be your everything, but they need to be many things. It's the most complex, multifaceted relationship you'll ever get into. And so I think there's a lot of pressure around making sure that you guys have an aligned sense of where you're going, what you're working towards, not just where you are in that moment.
As it relates to this, how should we think about compromise? You know, what mistakes do you think people make when thinking about not compromising enough or compromising too much?
A friend of mine introduced this term to me called horse trading. He said there's compromising and there's horse trading. So compromises are, you want Japanese food, I want Italian. And I go, okay, honey, let's go get Japanese tonight. You go, great. Or I go, well, what's your second pick? And you say, I could have pizza. And I go, yeah, pizza sounds fine. And so we compromise and we go get pizza. Horse trading is you go, I do not want Japanese. I want Italian. But I'll trade you. Let's do Japanese tonight. Can we do Italian tomorrow night? And so I think you have to be really clear about good compromises, horse trading, and bad compromises. Good compromises are good enough solutions that you can feel good about. Bad compromises are crappy solutions where neither one of you are actually very happy. And horse trading is accepting the reality that you're going to be really happy today and I'm going to be really happy tomorrow, right? That we're each getting something we want and finding the joy and happiness in like, hey, we're both getting what we want. We're just doing it on two different nights and I'm happy to do what you want tonight and what I want tomorrow. And it doesn't need to be formal. It doesn't have to be like an actual trade or point keeping. I wouldn't recommend that. But it's this idea that sometimes you're making these trade-offs. And my sort of contrarian viewpoint is that most people compromise too much in relationships. And what I mean by that is they make bad compromises. So they really want Italian food. Their partner really wants Japanese. Neither one of them want pizza, but they're willing to eat it. And so they go and they eat pizza. They both aren't enjoying it. Neither one of them are happy. And all they're doing is thinking, man, I wish we had gotten Italian or I wish we had gotten Japanese. I think that couples do this all the time. They make these bad compromises because they think that they have to and that they have to get to a place where they're in agreement on everything. And I think that it creates this really negative sentiment in the relationship. I think you have to be careful to not give up on the things you really believe in and that are a core source of your happiness. Like, those things, I think you have to set boundaries around and say, hey, actually, like these things are really important to me. And I just want to check in, like, is this okay with you? And if it's not, can I understand why? And maybe I can build some empathy and maybe there's like a little bit of wiggle room. But also, like, I want you to understand, like, these are my top five things, right? These are the five things I don't want to compromise on. And what are your top five things? And I think what can happen in relationships is you may give to your partner. And they may be getting all of their top needs met. And they don't even know that you're given, right? It hasn't been communicated that actually it's a compromise to stay up late or to get up early or to go out and socialize all the time because you'd really rather be at home or to stay at home and watch your movie instead of going out, right? Like, these are silent compromises. I don't think that you should put it in your partner's face. And again, it's not point keeping, but I think it's good to communicate. Hey, just so you know, this is a little outside of my ideal, my comfort zone. And I'm pushing. And the reason I'm pushing is because I value your happiness or I value our togetherness. And I think what happens in long-term relationships often is that people stop valuing their togetherness. They start to say, oh, you want Japanese food and I want Italian? Great. Let's each order takeout. We can eat next to each other. And maybe you go, well, that's totally fine. Everybody gets what they want. You go, okay, well, what's the next phase of that? You want to watch a horror movie and I want to watch a comedy? Great. Well, one of us can watch on the TV and the other one can open their laptop. And at some point, you're living parallel lives. You're no longer on the same path. When your partner is leaving every weekend to go on a fishing expedition in a trip and spend time out in nature, and you're spending every weekend going out in the city, and your friends are never seeing your partners, and you're just living completely separate lives, you've lost your togetherness. And the juiciness of the early relationship is like, I don't care if we eat Italian or Japanese. Like, I just want to spend all my time with you. Right. And so finding a way to keep that exciting and interesting and being really clear about your boundaries so you don't compromise on things that ultimately will just like grate and grate and grate at your happiness is really, really important. And so I just think it's really important for couples to think about like, what are good compromises? What are bad compromises? And what is horse trading? And how do you make sure you're communicating so that you don't feel like you're being taken advantage of or giving too much and not getting that back in return?
That's a great sort of framework. Are there any other communication frameworks or sort of templates or precedents that come to mind that you think other people might benefit from in relationships?
There's so much of the work that I do now. I feel like I probably learned the most about relationships by being in professional relationships and seeing kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so I really love this book, probably the number one management book that I recommend to people, at least on the how you manage people and communicate to them, is The 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership. And the reason why I like that book is because I think it teaches you quite a bit about how to interface with other humans. And so you learn things around what happens when people get on the defensive. And so it may be in your relationship that your partner shares something, you don't share the same opinion. And it's very common to get into a mode of being like, I need to convince them to think about it the way that I'm thinking about it. They're wrong, I'm right. And instead, you've got to figure out a way to say them feeling the way they feel is totally reasonable and is allowed. And it's not wrong or right. It's how they feel, right? That's totally acceptable. I might not feel that way, but they feel that way. And there's nothing wrong with that. And actually, you shared with me this tweet that I really liked about a woman that gave this talk, and she uses the term projecting. And I think that we do this often as we try to understand the outside world. I still find myself doing it today. And so the most common thing is, you know, when I have a coffee meeting with Eric, he is 20 minutes late. And that must mean that he doesn't like me or he doesn't value my time. And what you're doing is you're projecting. You're saying, well, if I was going to decide to be 20 minutes late to a coffee meeting, it would be because I don't value the person's time or I don't respect them. So therefore, Eric must be thinking just like I do. And the reason why he's 20 minutes late is because he feels that way about me. That's projecting. I'm basically projecting my value system and my belief system on you versus having the conversation. And we do this to people all day long. You know, people make a sharp left turn in front of us. Oh my God, this guy doesn't care about me. Like, you know, what a jackass, whatever this might be. And they realize like, actually he's doesn't have great vision and didn't see you. Or he's been waiting there for 10 minutes and finally had to make a left turn. And you know, you would have done the same thing. So like this projection, I think we have to be really careful about in our relationships where we incorrectly think that we just know our partners perfectly and we understand them. We start to project both our own feelings and these past experiences that we've had with them onto their behaviors. And I think the best thing we can do is stay in this place of, I call it the curious explorer. Like, how can you face these things that you confront that don't make sense to you with curiosity? Authentic curiosity. In coaching, we call it sometimes practicing inquiry. How can you learn to state questions and to explore authentically versus to cast judgments and make statements back to this person? And if you can do that, if you can like find that curiosity, like, wow, that's interesting. You know, my husband didn't do the five things that I asked him to do. That must be because blank. And you start to fill in the answers around that. And instead, you're legitimately bewildered. You text messaged him. You talked to him about it the night before. You put a post-it note, you know, on his desk to remind him in the morning. And yet he still didn't get these things done. So you could come at that from a place of frustration and judgment and anger. But when you do those things, you're putting the other person on the defensive and they close up. All they want to do is defend themselves. Like, they don't think they did anything wrong, or maybe they do, but they feel bad about it. And so they want to protect themselves against that. And you end up in this like lashing out at each other. And so in an ideal world, you get into a place of curiosity. Like, hey, I wanted to share how I'm feeling. This came up for me. And the story I'm telling myself is X. You can even name what that thing is that you're rejecting on them, but you're not actually doing it. You're just saying like, hey, this is what's coming up for me. It's frustrating. And if you get to a place where you have this shared language, I think it can be really helpful for couples. And so a lot of the stuff that I do on the coaching side, whether it's conscious leadership group or positive intelligence, like those things come up even in my relationship. And they have been incredible tools for us to communicate around these disagreements and for me to learn not to do as much of this projection and assumptions and judgments. And so I think if you're struggling with communication with your partner, or if you don't have shared language around this, reading those books, like Positive Intelligence is another great book, reading these and learning about how you communicate with other people can be an incredible tool.
And what do you say to people who are like, hey, this language feels too controlling or too manipulative, or it just doesn't feel like, I don't want to, you know, have HR conversations in my relationship or my close friendships? Or what do you say to that?
Yeah. So I think this comes back to authenticity. So I am not a fan of the like coach speak, if you will, you know, this idea that you feel, or therapist speak, where you feel like you're being condescended or talked down to. And I think it's kind of difficult when you're in this mode and you're emotionally stepping back and removing yourself from the situation that your partner is in. And so one, you have to make it a norm, like going through this together. I think if one person does it and the other person doesn't, it's going to probably feel that way. If you both go through it because you recognize that you don't have the tools and you want to paint with the right tools, then I don't think it's going to feel that way because you both have the language and you can communicate in the same way. I think, though, that it has to be authentic. The minute that you start to use this, and lots of people do, to try to manipulate your partner, you guys have to have some way of raising the flag and going, hey, I'm feeling like I'm being manipulated with this language. Like, can we pause? What's going on here? Right. And that's got to be a wake up call to snap them out of it and be like, okay, just give me the unfiltered version of what's going on. I think that you'll hit up against that edge something like 5% of the time, and 95% of the time it will help your communication. And so with that trade-off, I'm willing to do that. I'm sure if my partner was on this interview with me, he would tell you like, yeah, every once in a while, Jared says these things and I wish he wouldn't, or I can tell that it's this like coach speak, or I hear him talk to clients and, you know, this sounds like him talking to me. But I think he would tell you that overall, he's really appreciative and he's learned a lot about those tools as we've talked about it in his work and in our relationship, and that net, it really helps us. And in this partnership, I've been able to have really uncomfortable conversations and we've talked about really complex topics, and we've done it really early in the relationship because there's been this shared intentionality and the shared commitment to that communication.
It's very interesting. I'm curious how you think about timelines. Right. Also, how you think about sort of age gaps, like you mentioned, because that relates to timeline too, but also relates to other things. Because, you know, like for example, when you advise other, you know, men and women are of course different, but when you advise other men, you know, 10 years younger, 15 years younger, who are sort of thinking about this kind of planning, and of course, not everything can be planned, right? But how you know, but people can't have kids at any age necessarily, right? So, how do you think about timelines in terms of family planning for yourself, or what would you advise for others? And how do you also think about sort of, you know, sort of the age related to the partners?
So I think this comes back to this idea of shared path like shared timeline, shared path. If you want to have kids and your partner wants to have kids, but you have an idea of having them 10 years apart, then you have to figure out, is there a good compromise, a bad compromise, or a horse trade that you want to do around that, right? So like, it would be a bad compromise if you guys are going to feel bad about the outcome. Maybe you want to have kids right now, and maybe she wants to have kids 10 years from now. She may feel uncomfortable. She may feel like you've cut off some of the things she wanted to do over the next 10 years to have kids today. And you may feel like, I definitely want to have kids before I'm 35, and I'm going to be 37 5 years from now. So, you know, that also doesn't work for me. Like, neither one of us are winning. And so I think instead you need to be that curious explorer and understand what's behind the like tactical decision. Okay, you don't want to have kids past 35. What's behind that? What are your fears? What are your concerns? What are the things that you don't want to be true? Like, what's going on there? And the same thing for her. Why doesn't she want to have kids for 10 years? Is she worried about her career? Is she worried about it shifting her priorities, her timeline? Like, what is the fear that's around that? And then you go back to like, you're in a partnership. So as partners, can you solve for any of those things together? Maybe you couldn't solve for them alone. And so when this happens, like the most common thing that I see is my female friends that are getting into their mid-30s start to say, hey, I have this biological clock. There's major medical challenges that happen as my eggs age. And I don't want to wait because I'm worried about those complications with pregnancy, or I don't want to have a child after certain time in my life. And I have seen those couples consider egg freezing. I've seen them consider doing IVF with another person carrying the child. I've seen them consider all sorts of these things, but you can only decide that as a partnership. And some of those are very expensive. So let's say that you have this desire and you're okay with someone else carrying your child, but it's going to cost you $50,000. Well, maybe the trade-off is that as a partnership, you have to figure out how you're going to now create $50,000 to pay for that flexibility that you want. Maybe that paid flexibility allows for the man to have the child a little bit sooner and the woman to not have to go through pregnancy, but it requires this financial commitment from the partnership. Right. And so that would be a good compromise where you get to something that you both feel really good about and which doesn't require you guys to make changes to the thing that feel really authentic and important to you. And so I think this is what you have to consider when you think about kids or you think about other big challenges. Every relationship requires some compromises, and you have to consider like, what is underneath that? What are the fears? What are the hopes? What are the desires? What are the dreams? And maybe your partnership can actually enable things that you didn't think were possible. And if it can, like, what a beautiful thing to work with your partner on solutioning around kind of like a, you know, 1+1=3 solution where you both get what you want.
Similarly, you're also in a long distance relationship. So why are you in a long distance relationship? How did you guys meet? And how should people think about long distance relationships? People are usually quick to sort of cut them out. And I know there's some back and forth in the beginning about, hey, you know, is this the right thing to do at this stage of life, a long distance relationship? Or what's the right way to think about it?
And I'm so cautious about the right way to think about it, but I'll tell you my way, how I thought about it. So I'm in a very long distance relationship. My partner lives on another continent. And we, you know, when we met, I obviously didn't know that, you know, when I saw him across the way. And we spent some time together. And my initial reaction when he talked to me about dating was like, yeah, there's no way that's going to work. You live on a different continent. Like there's just no way that could work. And it's interesting because if I go back in time around what I thought were my non-negotiables, I had actually done some short dating. I'd gotten set up with two different people. Both of them lived in a different city. And I told myself after dating those two people, you know, this is just too difficult. I want to meet somebody who lives in Austin. Like, this is where I want to build my life. And I was really clear about it. I was like, look, I'm just not going to go on dates in other places. If I go to New York, I'm not going to go on any dates there because I'm looking for a partner in Austin. And I think one of the challenges is you can try to rationalize and figure out these emotional things, but it's called falling in love for a reason. It's not like you're not falling in logic or falling in rationale with somebody. You know, you're falling in love. Like, it comes from your heart. And so for some people, it's a very rational, like, they have a spreadsheet with coefficients and weightings and variables and whatever. Like, I'm sure those people exist. You have to know yourself. Like, that's not what the experience was for me. I met this person and had the most amazing, you know, 4 or 5 days of my life, and then couldn't stop thinking about him, but it just didn't work. It went against what I had rationally told myself, which was, I'm not going to date this person. They live far away. And who knows? Who knows what this is like in the real world? You know, when you're on a vacation and you meet somebody and you're with them for this unlimited amount of time and you have no other commitments and, you know, you don't have friends bothering you, you can spend all your time with them and it feels like bliss. But I always say, like, if you can't have a good time on vacation with somebody, you really shouldn't date them. Like, it's easy to have a good time on vacation with other people. And I realized, like, I just didn't want to build a relationship. I had a bunch of fears. I didn't want to build a relationship that was a vacation romance. I wanted to build a relationship on something that was representative of real life. Because there's this amazing blog post that I actually told you about. It's a 2-part series. I recommend every person listening to this goes and reads it. It's on Wait But Why, and it's How to Find a Life Partner, parts 1 and 2. And they say that it boils down to 2 questions that are reciprocal. Do you admire this person? And that's reciprocal. So do they admire you? And I think admire is such an important word there, because if you admire someone, you have to respect them. You have to be values aligned with them. You know, when you look at somebody and you look at the choices they make, you don't really admire them if you don't agree with kind of how they go about making choices in their life. And then the second is, do they make you a better version of yourself, and vice versa? And so as I think about those 2 questions, I think they're incredibly useful questions to ask yourself about any relationship for life partnership. I think if you answer no to these, and you have to be really honest, like, are these true in both directions? If they're true in one direction but not the other, that's not actually good enough. And this will rear its head at some point. At least in my experience, that's what I've seen. And so I told them, hey, I don't think we can date. You live on another continent. And my mind was kind of close to it. And then I spent some time with him a few months later, and I just couldn't stop feeling the way that I felt. My body just felt pulled to him. And I had to consider, like, is my right rational mind working against me? How do I feel about this person? Everything that I know about them. And I still said, you know, I obviously didn't know on 2 weeks of experience with them, like, is this going to be my person? But I knew there was something in me that just felt really strongly connected. And so I said, okay, I want to know more. You know, I want to experiment. I want to see what normal life is like. What are the things that I feel like I don't really have a good sense of? And the more time that I spent with him, the more convinced I was that I really admired him. And I could feel that he really admired me. And I watched in various aspects of his life. And it wasn't until we actually went and spent time with my family. And I think, you know, everyone has their own unique family dynamics. I would say there's a side of me that is only really present when I'm with my family. And so he got to see this other side of me, and watching how he related to my family and how he related to me, also in the friction, you know, in those frictionful points that we all have with family, seeing how he showed up in that, and that was a point of understanding and compassion and curiosity, really just made me feel so supported and met, and really answered that second one of, like, this person does make me a better version of myself. And I hope I do the same for him. So I think these are really good questions to ask yourself. I think the most difficult thing is the middle, you know, when it's really bad, it's easy to know. When it's really amazing and everything's, you know, incredible, it's good to see that. And you're going to have some friction points along the way. But where it's in the middle, I think it's really hard. And I'm just as guilty as many other people of dragging on relationships and breakups for longer than they should. But I think it goes back to exploring these, like, what are your non-negotiables? What are your core values and beliefs? And asking these 2 questions about your partner. And I think if you can do that, I wish somebody had told me that long ago, and I would have had those tools to consider and talk through, and the hard questions and conscious relating. I think had I had that, I could have answered the questions sooner that a certain partnership wasn't going to work out for me. And so hopefully these are all helpful to other people as they're navigating it.
And it's especially challenging when people, you know, get engaged or get married and they realize that, hey, you know, we were in COVID for a couple of years and now life is different, or just, hey, this person has had a real change in their values or life. And we've been together a few years and now it just doesn't look the same, but we've made these commitments. Maybe we even have kids, and they have to think about, do they just stay or do they go?
Yeah. And, you know, I think that I won't pretend like I know. I don't have kids. I come from a divorced family, but if I had kids with a partner, I think it would be incredibly difficult for me to then go, okay, yeah, I'm going to choose a separation, because you're right, the stakes are higher and there's more to consider, the impact on your kids and all these things. But I also think you have to consider the impact on your kids of staying in an unhealthy relationship that doesn't serve you, right? And so I know a couple, it's funny because I went to a talk she gave and her ex-husband was there and she calls him her husband. And she is involved, you know, they have a kid together and he is now in a new partnership and they're pregnant and they have this modern family, you know, like the previous wife is very much involved in the shared kid's life. And that kid thinks about this, you know, new partner as his stepmom. Like, this is the complexity. And so I think that we have to think about a modern take on where we are in the world. A friend of mine runs a podcast called Refamulation, which is reformulating what families look like. What does it look like when you give your egg to, you know, your brother and his husband and they have a child that's biologically, you know, yours, but actually they're the parents? You know, like, what does it look like when we go through these new ways, or when we co-parent with two couples or whatever it might be? But I think that if you go back to, hey, I'm in partnership with this person, I decided based on a shared belief and value system, that doesn't mean that we're the right partners for the rest of our lives. And if we're on the same page that if our paths are going like this, that we probably shouldn't force it to be this, then hopefully with that person, you have the tools to navigate, what does that next chapter look like as friends, as neighbors, as co-parents, as supportive partners in a new version of whatever that connection is, versus you didn't work on any of those tools, you didn't build that, and all you know is you don't love this person anymore, and you don't have any of those tools, and now it's just in this disagreement and in this grading. I think that's where we just kind of see it black and white, as either I'm going to be with this person or I'm not, either I'm going to communicate with them or I'm not going to talk to them at all. And I just think it's more nuanced, especially if you have intentionality in that connection to begin with.
And one thing that's really interesting is, you know, when you find your partner early in life, there's not a ton to compare it to in some sense. But when you've been in relationships for one or two decades, you know, sometimes people, and I've fallen into this trap too, of like, oh, you know, there was something about this thing that was great. There's something about that thing that was great. And you sort of, the standards almost get higher and higher to make some match. And so like one, I'm curious how you think about that, but one sample example question I'd ask you is like, is the person you've had the best chemistry with the person who you had the most values alignment? Like, are there some just like trade-offs of life as it thinks about, you know, as we think about these things?
Yeah. I think this is a hard reality that we're in, this like paradox of choice. And I think if you go back in time, my grandparents met when they were in high school in a little town in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And they were madly in love for over 50 years. And I don't think they had that many partners throughout their life, right? They didn't have that much to compare it to. But again, for them, they had a shared vision of success. It was deeply encultured into them, right? Their parents thought that a successful marriage and a successful life looked pretty similar. And so they were taught that. They were taught that when they went to synagogue. They were taught that when they were at home. They were taught that in the model that they saw in their parents. And so deeply ingrained in them, this like true north of what do I need to achieve as an individual was very similar. And so if your true north is I need to get married, have a financially stable relationship where we are secure and protected and we stay safe, and we have our needs met, and where we have children and those children are healthy and happy, and where we get to grow old together and at some point retire, and enjoy life and live out our days and be relatively healthy and be blessed with grandkids, and then we can die happy. I think that's roughly what my grandparents had in mind as a North Star for success. And I suspect if you interviewed them separately and asked them, their pictures of what they would put on that list are almost identical. And so at any point in that relationship, when they ask themselves, should I make a change? Should I blow up this thing that has served me and has helped me get towards my North Star? Or should I stay in it? They had to think back on all of the wins that they had had with that person on this really clear script of what success looked like. Today, it's a lot harder, right? We want to know, like, just take an example just of work. It used to be like, if you ask my grandpa if he had a good job, he's like, yeah, it's a great job. I get paid. I haven't been fired. Nobody yells at me. I have job security. You know, I got a raise last year. Like, I'm doing well. And you ask somebody today and they answer some of those things, but then they answer a lot of more subjective things. I don't know if I have values alignment with my company. I don't know if my founder believes in the same causes that I believe in. I don't know if my manager really understands me. You know, it's these like softer, squishier things. Those were not an expectation. They weren't a part of people's lives 50 years ago when they were at work, or to be honest, even 15 years ago at work. And so as these things come in where people start to believe that actually their happiness is multifaceted into all of these different areas, number one, it becomes a lot harder to be happier, right? Esther Perel talks about this, about how like it's never been harder to be happier, but the people that are happy now today are happier than they ever have been. And the reason why is because they're happy on 50 different characteristics. And it used to be that happiness was 10 characteristics. But the challenge with 50 characteristics to make you happy is if you only have 47, it's easy to think about those three that you're not happy around, right? And to maybe kind of like spiral on those. We experience negative emotions at about 7 times the rate of positive ones. So it's great that only 3 out of the 50 characteristics aren't what you want. But every time that negative thing happens, you experience it in this magnified way. And so I think that we have to be really mindful of this variety of facets, of all these different characteristics, all these different variables that we allow ourselves to bring in, and be careful that we don't turn our idealized partner into something that is just so far out of reality, where we're not willing to compromise, where we're not willing to accept something different than this person that we've made out of clay in our mind that doesn't actually exist in the real world. And so I think that's the challenge, is to like, figure out, how do you get back to that place that's reasonable? How do you reduce your list? Because otherwise, every year that goes by, we become more particular, we have more experiences, we become less compromising. Generally, people have more success, more money, more resources, so they have to compromise less. And it's easier to surround yourself with people with a shared viewpoint and to be in this echo chamber. And now you're going out into the world trying to find a partner, but you have this long list of requirements. I think it makes it very, very difficult. And I think if you ask most matchmakers, they would tell most of their clients, you're asking for too much. What are the things that really matter? And so I think if you can do that exercise with yourself, you can go into the relationship with clarity and with self-awareness around that, versus going into a relationship and then realizing you've expected too much. And then everything feels like red line. Everything feels like loss. Like, oh man, now I have to just give up all these things that I'm expecting from my partner, versus just realizing you can't expect that from anyone. And really zoning in on the things that matter.
Yeah, some people just say, like, instead of having, you know, really focusing on the criteria or list of, you know, of attributes, you know, maybe focusing on the feelings that they sort of elicit in you, or kind of how you said, the values. And of course, the values can be on the list too, of course, and the feelings as well. But that's different than, you know, certain height, you know, look, some things that, you know, may be important to some people, but, you know, may also be overrated in terms of lifelong compatibility.
Yeah, I heard a stat where on Hinge, I think it's like the most common characteristic to look for women to put a filter around height. And the number one thing they do is put a filter of like 6 feet or above. And turns out a tiny portion of the US population is 6 feet or above. And they've done some studies about long-term relationships, and there's zero correlation with height and long-term happiness in a relationship. And yet this is the filter. If you ask people, if you give them the option, like what color hair do you want them to have, and how tall should they be, and should they be muscular or should they be lean? You know, they'll start to go, I wasn't even thinking about that. But, you know, now that you've asked me, And so I think these dating apps are doing terrible things psychologically for us. They're teaching us that we should treat finding a partner like we treat searching on the internet, you know, that we can just have this like faceted search and go through and filter out everybody, and that it's this rational process. But the reality is, like, falling in love with somebody, there's some parts that you can think about and you can talk about your value system and your beliefs. And there's some part where you just have to listen to your body and listen to your feelings and see, how do you feel with this person? How does this person make you feel about yourself? How do you feel when you're around them? How do you feel like, you know, what is life like when they're in that life with you? What are you willing to do? Where are you willing to compromise? People say all the time, like, oh, I had no idea that you were really excited about moving to Europe. And I was like, what are you talking about moving to Europe? They said, well, you know, you're dating this European. Well, yes. But what do you mean moving to Europe? Well, presumably you're going to move, right? I was like, well, I don't know if I'm going to move. And no, I wasn't excited about moving to Europe. That was not part of my plan. But I fell in love with someone and I really value our togetherness. And if at some point I needed to be in Europe and be living here so that we could be together, I'd have to seriously consider that, even if it wasn't part of my plan, even if it wasn't what I wanted to do. And then you just end up in this, like, do I value the togetherness or do I value not living in Europe, right? And you have to have an open mind about exploring those things that maybe before you thought were totally off the table, but that was before you were in love. That was before you had spent X months or years building this relationship with this person. That was before you had, you know, on the scale of positives, this feeling that you didn't have before, right? And so I think you have to just be willing to hold these things loosely and re-examine them and explore them, but like check in and see how it makes you feel so that you don't commit to kind of rationalizing your way in or out of a relationship.
Just to check in, is there anything we haven't discussed that you think would be good to discuss? This is pretty great for me too. So meaning this, no immediate need to keep extending, but just wanted to make space for it.
I think this is good. I mean, I'd be worried if we're at an hour and 20 minutes. I don't know that we missed anything small or anything big.
One thing we didn't mention is sort of, I don't know if it's a small topic or even worth discussing, but is like you mentioned sort of, you know, gay or bi curious. I don't know if there's anything worth discussing as it relates to that.
I guess the biggest thing that I think about as a gay man is, if you think that what dating apps have done to straight relationships is bad, what dating apps have done to gay relationships is horrific, right? Like, physically, the means of interacting with other people has been so reduced, and we have just completely commoditized sex. And so you're feeding people what they want in the short term, and it's really easy for people to mistake that for having their core needs met. And so I think there's a lot of gay men that are in these short-term connections and hookups and whatnot, telling themselves that they have companionship. And many that are going to these hookups because they just feel like this loneliness or this desire to be validated or to be with someone intimately. And then they leave that and they feel bad about themselves. They judge themselves for it. They recognize that, you know, having sex with somebody and leaving isn't the same as, you know, making love to someone and staying and being in a connection with them. And so I worry that, you know, in an environment where we make sex so available to people and we completely disconnect it from relationship, sex feels like this evolutionary thing, like the pleasure around sex, where it was one of the things that was like glue that helped hold relationships together. It's like, hey, like you have a fight. I won't say, well, a version of a statement a friend of mine says is, there's few arguments that sex doesn't help with, you know. And it's like this idea of, you've heard of makeup sex and all of this, but this idea that there's this thing that just feels really good that you always have in your back pocket to come back to in a relationship. If you need to kind of like help make things a little better, you need to improve the closeness, you need to improve the connection, you can go back into sex. And when you take that out, you're kind of getting this, these endorphins release and all these positive things without the good and the bad of the relationship, right? Without the weight of a relationship. A relationship takes work. There's pros and cons to it. And I worry that we're teaching an entire generation that maybe they shouldn't do the work around relationships because they can just get sex. They don't need it. And now that's starting to proliferate into straight relationships and straight communities as well. And so I am worried at a time where, you know, our fertility rates are the lowest I think they've ever been in history in the United States, and our population is decreasing and marriage rates are lower. I think this is very problematic, where a lot of people are finding that maybe they just don't want to go on this path. And we're now seeing that there are a number of teenagers that are going through and they're just staying without, they hit 18 without ever having an intimate partner, and they're not engaging in the things around partnership. They may even skip over sex. And now we have technology creating companion apps, like, hey, can I have a companion app and I don't even have to deal with the loneliness? I can artificially feel like I'm not alone without all the work of a partnership. But if we do that and we play that out, like, we end as a society. And so that's a really challenging thing to kind of like wrap my head around, to say, like, are we hurting or helping our, you know, our humanity, our civilization, by creating and sort of making these elements of a relationship a la carte in a way that they never were in the past? And I worry most about that in gay populations, where I just think there's going to be, you know, now we're seeing gay people being able to adopt kids and build families and whatnot. But there's a lot of people in the gay community that have never had sort of a positive role model for relationships, and they haven't had positive experiences around intimate partners because they've had this alternative path that for so long didn't even exist in the straight community. And I worry that it has probably damaged the gay community.
While we're on this topic, maybe there's a last question. What about sort of the poly community? Would you say similar thing? Like, do you think they are happier, you know, have more like, how should we, what should we learn from what's happened there?
So I think this is similar to the Esther Perel comment on the people that are happy today are the happiest humans I've ever been, because they're happy on all these different characteristics. I think the same thing is true most likely for people in polyamorous relationships. In really healthy polyamorous relationships with great communications and structure and all of this, they have more love in their life. They're basically living in a village. They have more people around to co-parent and to have different needs met, and their partners can show up in different angles. But they're also juggling more complexity. And humans are complicated and emotions are complicated. And so I think that it's incredibly difficult to be in a very healthy, structured, polyamorous relationship. I would just say, like, markedly more difficult, it seems, than to be in a two-person relationship. But if you can do it, there are all these things that probably pay off. And it's the same thing of co-living. You know, when I live with multiple people, there's more people to live with. I have to deal with each of those people on their own path, what they're doing, what they want. There's a lot of benefits to it, but there's also some potential for conflict. And so if we have really good systems in place that can support me and my happiness and each of the other people that I live with in our collective happiness, but if we don't have those things in place, it can be very problematic. And so I'm not an expert on polyamorous relationships. There's a bunch of really great books on this. And I think the biggest thing is just understanding that you're juggling more, and understanding that that means you need to have even more tools for managing those dynamics, because you're now, that relationship that seems so tough when you're just in a relationship with one other person, now you have multiple of those relationships happening. And each of the people you're in relation with probably has a relationship with each other of one form or another. So you're really managing a large number of connections and the emotions that come with them.
One is even hard enough.
Yeah.
But anyway, Jared, we're at the hour, so I'm mindful of your time. This has been a fascinating and wide-ranging conversation. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your learnings with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great to talk to you about it.
Thanks for listening to Modern Relationships. Please make sure you're following on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. If you have a chance, leave us a review or comment on this episode to let me know who else you'd like to hear from on this show. Modern Relationships is a podcast from Turpentine, the network behind Econ 102, Upstream, and Turpentine VC.